Santan awoke, screaming. It had been a terrible dream, confused but deeply distressing. She had seen Michael again, not in the flaming body of the aeroplane, but riding Nuage. Michael's body was still blackened by the flames, and his hair was burning like a torch, and beneath him Nuage was torn and mutilated by the shells, and his blood was bright on the snowy hide, and his entrails dangled from the torn belly as he ran. "There's my star, Santen." Michael pointed ahead with a hand like a black claw. "Why don't you follow it?"
"I cannot, Michel," Santan cried. "Oh, I cannot."
And Michael galloped away across the dunes into the south, without looking back, and Santan screamed after him.
"Wait, Michel, wait for me."
She was still screaming when gentle hands shook her awake.
"Peace, Namchild," Hani whispered to her. "Your head is full of the sleep demons, but see, they have gone now."
Santan was still sobbing and shivering, and the old woman lay down beside her and spread her fur cape over them both and held her and stroked her hair. After a while Santan quietened down. The old woman's body smelled of wood smoke and animal fat and wild herbs, but it was not offensive, and her warmth comforted Santan, and after a while she slept again, this time without the nightmares. Hani did not sleep. Old people do not need the sleep that the young do. But she felt at peace. The bodily contact with another human being was something she had missed all these long months. She had known from childhood how important it was. The infant San was strapped close to its mother's body and lived the rest of its life in intimate physical contact with the rest of the clan. There was a saying of the clan, "The zebra on his own falls easy prey to the hunting lion," and the clan was a close-knit entity. Thinking thus, the old woman became sad again, and the loss of her people became a great stone in her chest, too heavy to carry. There had been 19 of them in the clan of Owa and Hani. Their 3 sons and their wives and the 11 children of their sons. The youngest of Hani's grandchildren was still unweaned, and the eldest, a girl whom she loved most dearly, had just menstruated for the first time when the sickness came on the clan. It had been a plague beyond anything in the annals of the clan and of the San, something so swift and savage that Hani still could not comprehend it or come to terms with it. It had started first as a sore throat, which changed to raging fever, a skin so hot that it was almost searing to the touch, and a thirst beyond anything the Kalahari itself, which the San called the Great Dry, could generate. At this stage the little ones had died, just a day or two after the first symptoms, and the elders had been so debilitated by the sickness that they did not have the strength to bury them, and their tiny bodies decomposed swiftly in the heat. Then the fever passed, and they believed that they had been spared. They buried the babies, but they were too weak even to dance for the spirits of the infants, or to sing them away on their journey into the other world. They had not been spared, however, for the sickness had only changed its form, and now there came a new fever, but at the same time their lungs filled with water, and they rattled and choked as they died. They died, all of them, except Owa and Hani. But even they were so close to death that it was many days and many nights before they were strong enough to appreciate the full extent of the disaster that had overtaken them. When the 2 old people were sufficiently recovered, they danced for their doomed clan. And Hani cried for her babies, that she would never again carry on her hip nor enchant with her fairy tales. Then they had discussed the cause and the meaning of the tragedy. They discussed it endlessly around their campfire in the night, grieving still to the depths of their beings, until one night Owa had said, "When we are strong enough for the journey, and you know, Hani,
What a fearsome journey it is. Then we must go back to the place of all life, for only there will we find the meaning of this thing, and learn how we can make recompense to the angry spirits who have smitten us so.
Hani became once more aware of the young and fruitful body in her arms, and her sadness lifted a little, and she felt the resurgence of the mother instinct in her milkless and withered bosom, which had been snuffed out by the great sickness.
It may be, she thought, that already the spirits are mollified because we have begun the pilgrimage, and that they will grant this old woman the boon of hearing once more the birth cry of a new infant before she dies.
In the dawn, Hani unstoppered one of the little buckhorns that hung from her girdle, and with an aromatic paste dressed the sun blisters on Santan's cheeks and nose and lips, and the grazes and bruises on her legs and arms. Chattering away to her, she worked. Then she allowed Santan a carefully measured ration of water. Santan was still savouring it, holding it in her mouth as though it was a rare Bordeaux. When, without further ceremony, the two San stood up, turned their faces northwards, and sat off along the beach in that rhythmic jog-trot. Santan sprung up in consternation, and without wasting breath on entreaties, she snatched up her club, adjusted the canvas hood over her head, and started after them. Within the first mile, she realized how the food and rest had strengthened her. She was at first able to hold the pair of tiny figures in sight. She saw Hani prod the sand with her digging stick, scoop up a sand clam almost without breaking stride, and hand it to Owa, then pluck another for herself and eat it on the run. Santan sharpened one end of her club to a point and imitated her, at first unsuccessfully, until she realized that the clams were in pockets in the beach, and Hani had some means of locating them. It was useless to scrape at random. From then on, she dug only where Hani had marked the sand and drank the juice from the shells thankfully as she trotted along. Despite her best efforts, Santan's pace soon flagged, and gradually the two San drew away from her and once again disappeared from her view. By midday, Santan was down to a dragging walk and knew that she had to rest. As she accepted it, she lifted her eyes and recognized far ahead of her the headland of the seal colony. It was almost as though Hani had divined the exact limit of her endurance, for she and Owa were waiting for her in the rock shelter, and she smiled and chittered with pleasure as Santan dragged herself up the slope into the cave and fell, exhausted, onto the floor beside the fire. Hani gave her a ration of water, and while she did so, there was another lively argument between the old people, which Santan watched with interest, noticing that every time Hani pointed at her, she used the word Nam. The gestures that the old people made were so expressive that Santan was sure she understood the old woman wanted to stay for her sake, while Uwa wanted to go on. Every time Hani pointed at her mate, she made that kissing pop of her lips. Suddenly, Santan interrupted the discussion by also pointing at the little bushman and saying, Owa! They both stared at her in stupefied amazement, and then, with delighted squeals of glee, acknowledged her accomplishment. Owa! Hani prodded her husband in the ribs and hooted. Owa! The old man slapped his own chest and bobbed up and down with gratification. For the moment, the argument was forgotten, as Santan had intended, and as soon as the first excitement had passed, she pointed at the old woman, who was quick to understand her query.
Hani?
She enunciated clearly. On the third attempt, Santan sounded the final click to Hani's satisfaction and high delight.
Santan!
She touched her own chest, but this precipitated shrill denials and a fluttering of hands.
Nam child!
Hani slapped her gently on the shoulder, and Santan resigned herself to another christening.
Nam child!
she agreed.
So, revered old grandfather, Hani rounded on her husband, Nam child may be ugly, but she learns fast, and she is with child. We will rest here and go on tomorrow. The matter is at an end.
And grumbling under his breath, Owar shuffled out of the shelter. But when he came back at dusk, he carried the fresh carcass of a half-grown seal over one shoulder, and San Ten felt so rested that she joined in the ceremony of thanksgiving, clapping with Hani and imitating her piping cries while Owa danced around them and the seal meat grilled over the embers. The ointment which Hani had used on her injuries brought rapid results. The raw burns and blisters on her face dried up, and her skin with its Celtic pigmentation darkened to the colour of teak as it became conditioned to the sun, though she used her fingers to brush out her thick dark hair to shade as much of her face as possible. Each day she grew stronger as her body responded to hard work and the protein-rich diet of seafood. Soon she could really reach out with her long legs and match the pace that Owa set, and there was no more lagging behind or argument about early halts. For San Tan it became a matter of pride to keep up with the old couple from dawn until dusk.
"I'll show you, you old devil," she muttered to herself,
fully aware of the strange antagonism which Owa felt towards her, but believing that it was her weakness and helplessness and her drag on the party that was the cause. One day, as they were about to begin, and despite the old woman's protests, she took half the water-filled ostrich eggs from Hani's load and slung them in her canvas shawl. Once Hani realized her intention, she acquiesced willingly and ribbed the old man mercilessly as they set out on the day's trek.
"Namchild carries her share just like a woman of the sun," she said.
And when she had exhausted her jibes, she turned all her attention to San Tan and began her instruction in earnest, pointing with her digging stick, and not satisfied until San Tan had the word right or showed that she understood the lesson. At first, San Tan was merely humouring the old woman, but soon she was delighting in each fresh discovery, and the day's journey seemed lighter and swifter as her body strengthened and her understanding grew. What she had at first believed was a barren wasteland was, instead, a world teeming with strange and wonderfully adapted life. The kelp beds and underwater reefs were treasure houses of crustaceans and shellfish and sea worms, and, occasionally, the low tide left a shoal of fish trapped in a shallow rock pool. They were deep, full-bodied fish with gunmetal gleaming scales and a slightly greenish tinge to the flesh, but when split and grilled on the coals, were better than turbot. Once they came across a nesting colony of jackass penguins. The penguins were on a rocky island connected to the mainland by a reef across which they waded at low tide, although San Tan had shark horrors all the way over. The thousands of black and white jackass penguins nested on the bare ground and hissed and brayed with outrage as the bushmen harvested the big green eggs and filled the canvas carrying bag with them. Roasted in the sand under the fire, they were delicious, with transparent, jelly-like whites and bright yellow yolks, but so rich that they could only be eaten one at a time, and the supply lasted many days. Even the shifting dunes with precipitous slip faces of loosely running sand were the homes of sand-burrowing lizards and the venomous side-winding adders that preyed upon them. They clubbed both lizards and adders and cooked them in their scaly skins, and after San Tan had mastered her initial aversion, she found that they tasted like chicken. As they trekked northwards, the dunes became intermittent, no longer presenting an unbroken rampart, and between them were valleys whose bottoms were of firm earth, albeit as bare and as blasted as the dunes or the beaches. Hani led San Tan over the rocky ground and showed her succulent plants which exactly resembled stones. They dug beneath the tiny, inconspicuous leaves and found a bloated root the size of a football. San Tan watched while Hani grated the pulp of the root with her stone scraper, then took a handful of the shavings, held them high with her thumb pointed downwards like a teat on a cow's adder, and squeezed. Milky liquid ran down her thumb and dribbled into her open mouth, and when she had squeezed out the last drop, she used the remaining damp pulp to scrub her face and arms, grinning all the while with pleasure. Quickly, San Tan followed her example. The juice was quinine bitter, but after the first shock of the taste, San Tan found that it slaked her thirst more effectively than water alone, and when she had scrubbed her body with the pulp, the dryness caused by wind and sun and salt was alleviated, and her skin felt and looked cleaner and smoother. The effect was to make her aware of herself for the first time since the shipwreck. That evening, as they sat around the fire waiting for the kebabs of limpets threaded on a piece of driftwood to broil, San Tan whittled a stick, and, with the point cleansed between her teeth, and then used her forefinger, dipped in evaporated crystals of sea salt that she had scraped from the rocks, to scrub them again. Hani watched her knowingly, and after they had eaten, she came and squatted behind San Tan and crooned softly to her, and she used a twig to pick the knots and tangles out of her hair, and then dressed it into tight new braids.